Welcome to PNC C-Speak, the language of executives. I'm Josh Schimmels, publisher and CEO of the Los Angeles Business Journal.
And I'm Todd Wilson, regional president of Greater Los Angeles for PNC Bank.
Every episode, we sit down with leaders who've built, scaled, or reimagined companies that shape the way Los Angeles does business.
Today's conversation centers on a company that, in many ways, operates behind the scenes, but at a remarkable global scale. Bobrick Washroom Equipment has spent more than a century building a reputation around precision manufacturing, reliability, and design, serving commercial spaces across more than 100 markets worldwide.
It's the kind of business that doesn't always carry what we like to call a consumer-facing spotlight, but it plays a critical role in the infrastructure of everyday life, from office towers and airports to healthcare facilities and to stadiums. At the center of that story is a leader. It's a leader whose career reflects both continuity and evolution.
It also exemplifies one of those businesses in Los Angeles, a family-owned business that has been around for over 100 years. Mark Lockheim has spent 45 years with Bobrick, rising through the organization from project manager to chairman to CEO, bringing a ground-level understanding of the business to the highest level of leadership.
It's a perspective that's especially relevant today as companies navigate things like global complexity, operational scale, and long-term strategic growth. And as a part of our family business series, which we're very excited about, this conversation also explores what it takes to sustain leadership and legacy across different generations, all while continuing to innovate and adapt. Mark Lockheim, welcome to C-Speak.
Josh and Todd, thank you for having me.
So you've spent 45 years at Bobrick, working your way through a lot of different roles. You started as a project manager, and now you're the CEO. What did starting towards the bottom teach you about leadership that maybe you wouldn't have learned had you done it a different way?
Yeah, just to give you a little context, when I was in high school, and kids don't do this anymore, but I actually had a job in high school, you know, when I was there. Unfortunately, it's harder for them to do that today. In fact, one summer I spent as a janitor at Hollywood Bowl, which was a great summer job.
Oh, nice.
I spent my summers in college selling books door to door, rising to become an organizational manager. And then after college, I worked for Procter & Gamble in manufacturing and their paper products division as a first line supervisor. So I had that experience and then went off to business school before joining company. So I understood that when I joined the company, that if I wanted to have influence within the company, I really had to do every assignment extraordinarily well. And that coming into Bobrick with the same last name as my father and my grandfather had its own set of perils. There were people who wanted me to be successful and those who didn't. So for me, it was really walking in with humility and focusing on learning the business.
And you've seen the business from obviously every level. How has this shaped your approach to leadership, to running the company, to managing change?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When my grandfather asked a question, the worst thing you could tell him is we've always done it that way. And so for me, accepting conventional wisdom has always been a problem. I mean, think about conventional wisdom. It's simply just an accumulation of experience. And when trends change, when things change, you really need to take a fresh look at those things. The decision process itself doesn't change, but as you rise in the organization, the consequences of your decisions do. So I think what has become harder, I think certainly is in the more recent days, the level of unknown and uncertainty that we face. And COVID, I think, was a great example of that, where we saw that we only had 10% of the information, but we had to live with 100% of the consequences. And so that really sort of taught us on a decision-making basis to really operate with greater agility and to continue to iterate as we went through those problems.
Well, I think a lot of companies, they see, to your point, doing things the way they've always been done, that can stifle innovation.
Correct.
You know, one of the things that you've instituted, I know, is the Bobrick Management Development Program, which I understand is designed to help employees develop a broader range of knowledge and skills to kind of make them better leaders, more well-rounded. What inspired you to think through this and develop such a kind of...
Well, it's not novel with us. I mean, I always admired General Electric, and this is sort of even the pre-Jack Welch days. Mm-hmm. I worked at Procter & Gamble, which had a great management development system. And so I really just copied what I saw at P&G and what I had learned about from GE. So for me, it was really understanding that for a formal management development program backed by training and mentoring where we rotate our managers and people coming into the management development program through line positions and staff positions, you really get to see how they succeed in a variety of different roles and really give them the opportunity to shine. And they get a much deeper understanding of the overall business. So we've put that in place. And when you think of the 13 managers in our company that are at the VP level or higher, 11 of them came through as from entry level through entry level. And in fact, if you look at the president of the Quality Division, he had 12 different assignments. He was the manufacturing manager at our Gamco division in Oklahoma. He was the division manager at our Thrissleington division in Wales. He started in LA, then relocated back to LA in terms of head of our manufacturing operations. And then moved to Denver to become the president of Koala, and he's 42 years old.
So P&G, consumer products, I imagine you got amazing training. Was this at their headquarters in Ohio? Is it somewhere else?
I was in Bohupany, Pennsylvania.
Oh, Pennsylvania. Okay. So not too far.
It was in a paper products plant in northeastern Pennsylvania. No, it's sort of funny because I went to Cornell undergrad, and I used to drive down to Philadelphia to visit friends. And I would drive down 81, and I would see Scranton and Wilkes-Barre. And on the one side, there's slag piles, and the other side is the world's largest old rubber tires, just junk. And I would say, this is the last place on this green earth I would ever want to live. And sure enough, I end up working there.
Fresh out of Ivy League, you got to go to Pennsylvania.
Lived in Tunkhannock. And it was actually just a great experience, a beautiful part of the world, and really enjoyed it. My experience at P&G was just great.
It prepared you for looking at global impact and global awareness and global dominance. You've now got manufacturing facilities in 100 markets, right, around the world. Let me ask you this. What has been maybe the biggest challenge or a few of the biggest challenges that you experienced in scaling a business that touches so many different geographies?
Well, I think you'll find this in a lot of companies, but people and building culture, we have physical operations. We have 5 plants in the U.S., 1 in Canada, 1 in Wales, sales offices in the Middle East, London, India, Australia. So in really the breadth of the world in terms of where our folks are, but the people and the culture and making sure that we continue that and maintain that throughout the organization is really a challenge. For us, when we started out with like a greenfield facility, like we built a plant in Jackson, Tennessee, there we have the opportunity to hire people. You're hiring for values, you're hiring for abilities. And so it's easier than doing an acquisition. And so we've done, the hardest challenge for us is the acquisitions we've done. So in 2004, we bought Koala, which was a very successful division within a very troubled company. And in fact, our VP of marketing and our VP of sales actually came out of there. So the transfers just don't go one way. We do transfer our folks into these new divisions for their development. And that's a great way for us to sort of keep the culture across the organization. Then the second one was Gamco. And this was really more of a troubled division that we bought from Masco. They had a series of presidents, like every 6 to 12 months, they had a new president come in with different priorities. And so that had its own sets of challenges that we had. That was really more of a turnaround situation. And then the last acquisition in 2018 was the Thrissleington Cubicles in Wales. And there's clearly a very different culture. And for us, it was sort of taking the tribal knowledge of the way they developed that product. And so that became a real challenge there. And also helping our hourly employees understand, the management employees, they need to understand that they're now part of the management development program, and we transfer them even from acquisitions into other locations and other people in. And part of the role of the hourly employees is to help train our management team. And by the same token, when we hire our hourly non-exempt employees, they understand they're not coming in for a job. They're coming in for a career. And in fact, a couple of our division managers, one of our VPs, actually started out as hourly employees. So we're constantly pushing for them to grow. So for a company in an acquisition where they're used to saying, you do your job, don't tell us what we ought to be doing, we're just the opposite. We really look to our hourly employees for, tell us what the problems are. What do you see in terms of the things that we need to do? What are the problems that you're having? And then also giving them more skills and helping them grow in the organization, critical thinking skills, as well as leadership skills, training, and others. So that's a big difference. And it's a challenge for a bigger challenge when you do an acquisition.
How many employees do you have now?
We don't publicly release that. I'll tell you it's over 500.
Over 500, I imagine. I mean, you almost have over 500 locations.
Mark, you obviously talked about the worldwide footprint, but I've had the privilege to go out to your facility here in Los Angeles, and I know you're very active civically in Los Angeles. California and Los Angeles aren't always thought of as a business-friendly place to do work, but your headquarters are here, your biggest facilities here. What do you do, or what can you do to help support the local economy?
Well, as you know, Todd, I'm involved with the chamber. I co-chair the CEO Council. And so it's educating them about the need to get engaged and to help us elect leaders who are going to help improve the situation so we have a thriving economy.
And the company is also committed to manufacturing in the United States, okay? How has that philosophy helped shape culture and also impacted and directed long-term business strategy?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's sort of actually a little bit of the reverse. It's actually the strategy that started the philosophy. I never bought into the conventional wisdom that all manufacturing was going to be outsourced and offshored. We saw the renaissance, and this goes back to the 1990s. We saw the renaissance that was taking place with the development of numerical controls, lasers, and robotics, and understood implications of lower cost, better quality, improved control of the supply chain, all of which would result in better value to our customers. So our willingness to commit to those investments really came from a rather intensive long-range planning process. In 2000, our strategy 1.0 had a pillar of manufacturing 3.0, which is basically automation. And in our second strategy, which we put out in 2015, our long-range strategies have a tendency to last 10 to 15 years. And in the second one, the pillar was manufacturing 4.0, which is really going from automation to autonomous. We've made huge investments there because we see it as a real source of competitive advantage. And so when you layer that on top of our employee development program, every laser, every robot, automated equipment all led to higher value work for our employees. And in the process, we eliminated a lot of tedious work, we lowered our costs, improved the quality, and we never eliminated a job. So a lot of the ideas and suggestions that we get on that innovation actually come from our hourly employees. And it's been a great source of competitive advantage.
So we talk about manufacturing and manufacturing innovation. Let's switch to product for a second.
Okay.
Most consumers, or many of the consumers, have used the Boebrick products without ever having realizing it, probably. How do you think about innovation and innovation of products? Does it come from your customers? Does it come from your employees? Does it come from the top down? How do you think about innovating something that is a more traditional, boring product?
I'm going to go back to talking about that first strategic plan, because we realized we needed to invest more heavily into engineering and marketing resources and really improve our product development process.
Talk about for a second, your core products, just so for the audience who may not be as familiar. What are your core products today?
So we make basically all the stainless steel products that you see that goes into a non-residential building, whether it's an airport, office building, hospital, school, you name it, every public restroom. Yeah, this company had started as a chemical company in 1906, Gabriel Boebrick, who founded the company here in Los Angeles in sort of the Elysian Park area, invented the first liquid soap dispenser in 1908, and then the first lavatory mounted soap dispenser for the Pullman car companies in 1912. So those products have been around for a long, long time, and really one of our core competencies is the area of soap dispensers. And then that evolved into other bathroom accessories and into recessed accessories. So today we make everything that goes into a bathroom in a non-residential building except for the plumbing. We don't do the porcelain and really don't do the faucets, but those are all the products, the grab bars, napkin tampon vendors, Talon waste units, toilet tissue dispensers, and the like.
How many SKUs do you have? Do you know?
You know, it just depends on sizes. You get into mirrors, it gets sort of complicated, and all the different variations that we can have. Boebrick's been around for 120 years. But people don't really know it. So I said, well, we make the Koala baby changing stations.
Anyone with kids knows exactly what that is.
And they know exactly what that is. They get to put that big logo on, and we've been able to sort of keep that Koala logo on the product. Most architects, they don't even want to show your product name. And we have a very small, you got to really look for it. A lot of times you can't find it, but we have a logo there.
Well, your products, they have to stand the test of time, right? It's high volume. How do you balance things like innovation and durability and, of course, dependability when the products need to perform for years in high traffic environments? You said these are commercial buildings. How do you mix those two?
And our products are also non-proprietary. So it's not like a Georgia-Pacific or Kimberly-Clark. They're going to sell you a dispenser that will only dispense their product. Mm. So we have to use everybody's soap, everybody's paper. And so that becomes a challenge in terms of making sure that when you pull a paper towel, you get one paper towel, you don't get a whole bunch, all those sorts of things. So it's really just thinking about the building owner as our ultimate customer and them wanting to serve their patrons. And the fact that our products really have to last the life of the building. When they redid the Century Towers, they took all of our accessories out, they redid the bathrooms, and they put all our accessories back in.
The same ones.
And so I go, well, that's great. That's a real testament to the product. But boy, I would have liked to have sold some of the products.
Right. Almost too good.
But it's also making sure we have the right product for the right application. A high school and an airport is a very different application than a downtown office building where they want something a little bit more of a premium product. But it's really understanding what those needs are and talking with architects and helping them craft the right solution for their owner.
So what are some recent innovations then that you might be able to show us or talk to us about?
Probably the most recent innovation is the smart washroom. This is something that didn't come from an architect. We can talk about where we get our ideas from. One of the pillars in our second strategic plan is embrace the digital world. Everyone is sort of following what's going on with AI and with smart. When COVID happened, everyone wanted no touch everything. By the way, what I tell people about no touch products is it's great if you want them. But the reality is there's no reason really to have them. A bar of soap is just as hygienic as a soap dispenser. But smart is one of the things where we're seeing some growth. We started in toilet partitions. It was actually for the Bloomberg headquarters in New York. They wanted light indicators on the door. And so we started with that. When you close the door, the light will turn red. Otherwise, it's white. We're doing a lot of those in airports right now. And those are now connected to basically a building automation system in the building. And so, and we've added in toilet tissue dispensers and other product soap dispensers that have level indicators. So that really helps the maintenance department understand where they need to go.
When they need to be cleaned, when they need to be changed.
And when you add in the AI component, and we work with a couple of partners on the AI side, they will help the building operator to show them what the most efficient way to maintain those restrooms.
That's great. So rather than checking every hour and going and signing off, they can just see digitally what services are needed and where.
Right. And one of the other innovations that we have, and you're going to start to see it at some of the major airports across the United States where we're redoing all the toilet partitions with our Thrislington product line. There's a screen showing you how many available toilets there are, and if they're full, where the next restroom is, where they can go. So that's just another innovation that we're doing.
So that sounds like that's trend-based. Let me ask you this. When it's not based on trends, how do you decide where to invest?
We're always sort of looking at the marketplace. And a lot of the new ideas in the restroom area actually come from the aftermarket. It's from companies like Georgia-Pacific and Kimberly-Clark. Things like the jumbo roll toilet tissue, which you've seen those, that started out as a proprietary product where you had to buy their dispenser to be able to utilize that. Over time, as the patents came off, that became something that became more of an industry standard. And then we also look at places like what's going on in Europe. And that's where I think one of the trends around gender became more important when people want more full privacy in toilet stalls today. And so we see a huge growth in that end of the market. And then things like adult changing stations, that's a big growing market for us. Some places where it's mandated, some airports in some states require an adult changing station as well.
So we've talked about your products, we've talked about your facilities. Let's switch a little bit to the business itself and the family nature of the business. Are you Generation 3, is that right?
I'm Generation 3.
And you and your son, Matthew's become more involved recently and you followed a-
He's very, the president, I work for him now.
That's got to be exciting.
Mm-hmm. Going to work every day with your son?
It's great.
You followed similar pathways though, right? Because he was out of the business, then he's come in and kind of worked from the bottoms up. Talk about, this was clearly deliberate for him and his leadership.
Well, A couple of things. I had one of the great pleasures of my life was the ability to work with my grandfather for 20 years. I mean, how many people get to do that? And then to be able to work with my dad, and we'll talk a little bit about transition, but we have a requirement that for family members, you have to work outside the business first, 3 to 5 years, depending upon whether you have a graduate degree. So that's an absolute requirement. And that really, I think, is important. You have to prove to yourself that you are capable and doing well and successful in a different environment and with a boss who doesn't know, you know, yep. doesn't know who you are, doesn't care who you are. That's really important because when I was talking about the perils, it's very easy as family members not to be treated the same as other managers. And so when I found that people were treating me differently, I had to put a stop to that. So I think that was important, that outside experience. And Matthew's, you know, a very smart kid, went to Yale, worked a couple of different jobs, graduated, went to Stanford Business School, and then was working for BCG. So he actually took a pay cut to come work for us. And that was, I think, a real sort of challenge. In fact, Kathy said to me, you know, you're going to have to give him a signing bonus. You cannot let him, you know, come.
Was that his decision for you to come, or your decision, or mutual?
I think it was mutual. I mean, he's a shareholder. He graduated 2008 from Stanford. So everyone was off doing startups. And so that was really kind of the push. But I think he saw the value of working with me and my father. His grandfather saw the value of that, and also creating value for him and the broader family. So that's why he came in.
So we have the opportunity pretty often and regularly to write about and to interview family businesses. And as a part of this family business series on this podcast, we have had and we are going to continue to have an opportunity to meet with amazing leaders. And one of the things that we've seen is just how rare it is for a family business to get to that fourth generation. What have you learned about shaping legacy? We touched on this a little bit earlier. How do you really do that?
Yeah, I think the key for us was really, and it's one of the things I really brought to the company, was a focus on long-range strategic planning. And I'm not talking about going to Palm Springs for the weekend and figuring out what your long-range plan is, but our first strategic plan took 5 years. Our second one took 3 years, where you're really intensely going in and looking at the business, looking at all the forces that are taking place. You're taking a look at the competitors, the way they behave. You look at what the trends are and how that's going to impact suppliers and customers and the rivalry within the business and what the natural barriers to entry are and the barriers to exit. You look at all of those things with a position of no sacred cows. And so when you do that, those issues of legacy and, you know, well, my grandfather never did this or never did that, all of that sort of goes out of the window. And you can really anchor change to that, number one. And number two, because we have a management development program and all the leaders that we have, the VPs today, were people that led the strategic planning process. They get a very deep understanding of the competitors, the marketplace. And so everybody is excited about not just what the trends are and where we need to be, but how do we position ourselves? And then how do we accelerate those trends in the industry to improve our competitive position? And the other thing in terms of legacy, you know, we don't really think about that. What I really think about is more of stewardship on the family side, because that's the other piece of it, which is how do you do it and still keep it a family business? I will tell you one of the interesting things, we're talking a little bit about Matthew joining the business. I was a little concerned about how is this going to be perceived in terms of Matthew coming in. And one of the surprises I had was that people were relieved when he joined the business, because they knew based on that we weren't going to be, you know,
sell the private equity. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, right. You know, so I've been very involved with an organization called Young Presidents Organization, which you're, and probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with. And I've co-chaired the family business retreat. One of the things we talk about is family offices are usually the result of a failure of family business, right? Because they've had a liquidity event and they're done. And so family businesses really do give you the opportunity to bring a family together. They are not ever neutral. They either bring a family together or they tear them apart.
Yeah.
And so by bringing them together, you have an opportunity to pass wealth on through generations in a way that's truly unique. We think about it as stewardship, that we're taking care of the family for the long term. So
that's great.
And so you are chairman and CEO, Matthew's president. How do you collaborate together? You know, leadership, are there systems, are there philosophies, are there rituals that make this partnership work?
Yeah, well, first of all, we talk a lot. We're not too far away from each other in the office. And he has a very good sense of where I am on different things. Though I will say we are very careful not to talk shop when our spouses are, you know, when we're family, that we really keep that in the office. But I think ultimately we respect what each person brings to the table. And we understand we have rules of engagement. I stay out of his weekly staff meetings. I stay out of his product development meetings. He's got authority to spend $1 million without coming to me. So that's, you know, all those things that really sort of help him drive the business in the way he believes is the right way. And he knows when he needs my input so that I'm not going to be surprised.
So it's both trust and mentorship at the same time.
It is. But we also have monthly meetings with advanced agendas. And finally, I think one of the real secrets to share is we both use the same coach. And so when there is an issue, we will actually bring in the coach to help facilitate through that. And it's been
mediate
really helpful.
Or facilitate?
I would say facilitate.
Is there another family member who could mediate this? Maybe.
No.
His mom?
Well, she's the ultimate chairman in terms of what happens.
It seems like you've got coordination. This is a well thought out process and you've got the coach. Is there a big lesson learned about how you prepared Matthew to lead the next generation?
First of all, he rotated through a variety of different assignments. His first job, he was a field analyst to begin with, and then he was a first line supervisor on the factory floor. And then he took an assignment in marketing, he took an assignment in sales. So I think for me, it was important that he had a good knowledge of the customer because we have you have a building developer, you've got a general contractor, you've got an architect. Sometimes you have an independent specification writer, you've got the subcontractor to the GC, and all of these touch the product and end up being part of that decision. So understanding how that supply chain works, the value chain works, is really important. And then also understanding on the manufacturing side, where do we get our source of competitive advantage? Because we really pride ourselves on being the most efficient manufacturer in the industry. So when you can be the most efficient manufacturer and at the same time have the highest value product, that's a formula for success. And so he understood those things, and that was an important part of his development coming on board.
Mark, obviously one of the biggest issues facing any family business is the concept of succession. We've seen the HBO show or the dramatization of this.
I hope it's not like that.
by the way, I refuse to watch that show. Okay. It just makes me so uncomfortable to see family businesses that don't function.
So many of our listeners here own family businesses and think about succession on a daily basis. What's the one thing you think is underestimated when preparing the next generation?
It's actually pretty simple. I think planning, which is really a multi-year process. It starts with an individual development plan for Matthew. I mean, as he was successful through the business, we said, okay, we believe that he's going to be the next president of the company, making sure that he's getting his development plan correct, that he's getting the variety of different assignments, and then also involving the board of directors. We have an independent outside board of directors. And to me, that's also one of the real secrets.
The majority of the directors are independent?
Yes. And that's one of the things that's really been one of the real secrets for our success because it sort of separates the governance of the business from the business of the family. But the board was very involved in the transition, approving what we were doing, and then providing feedback along the way. So that's been a real critical role. And then developing the plan and the transition plan. And that's where we brought in this outside facilitator to really help create the onboarding, in essence, to the president role. That's been really...
Are there any other family members that are involved in the business?
My brother-in-law was. He just retired.
Okay.
But no, it's just Matthew and me at this point. But I think the other thing in terms of transition is it's not just the leadership of the business. It's also about the equity in terms of the stock. And so you need to have both an estate plan and a process for getting shares down to the next generation. Mm. And that was one of the things that my grandfather, when he designed all of this in terms of transition, was very important. His sister's family's business end up not having an estate plan. They had to go public as a result of it. Okay. And so that's another sort of exit strategy. I mean, today it's a $1 billion, very successful company, but that isn't what the family wanted.
Fair enough.
And so the family, you know, isn't together the way.
You don't want those outside influences to drive your decision.
Correct. And so today we have about 65% of the stock is down in the fourth and fifth generation. And so we're continuing to work to make that happen. But that's the other key part too, is because you don't want to have a divorce or a death to force a liquidity event.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. We're coming down to the last minute or so here. We're going to switch things up. We're going to do something kind of fun. Let's do a speed round of questions. So for this part, I'm going to ask you a question and Todd's going to ask you a question. And just give us the first thing that comes into your mind. Quick, snappy answers. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right, here we go. Favorite place in Los Angeles to unwind when you're not working?
Craig's Restaurant in West Hollywood.
One word, this is tough, one word that describes your leadership style?
Post-heroic.
Big picture or details?
False choice.
I don't know how I'd answer that one.
You have to do, I mean, really think about it. You know, you both have to really understand the big picture in terms of, especially as a leader of a large organization, but also know when and how to be able to drill down into the details, making sure that people understand the assumptions to the decisions that they're going to be making.
All right. You have to get rid of one. Phone calls or emails?
You can add texting too. again, I think it's a false choice. I think it all depends. The phone is not used enough.
I was going to ask your favorite place to eat in LA, but I know it's Craig's.
It is Craig's.
So what's your favorite dish at Craig's?
I do something that's not on the menu.
Is it named after you? Because next time I go, I can ask for it?
No, I do the chicken piccata, no piccata.
Which is worse than LA, traffic or parking?
Traffic.
Okay.
Agreed.
Favorite place for a meeting? Coffee, lunch, or the golf course?
Lunch.
By the way, you sort of led him on that one. I think I know where you wanted the answer to.
I was hoping we could go out and play this afternoon or something.
I think lunch is just, it's a great opportunity to get to know somebody. And a coffee really isn't quite enough. I'll do a breakfast, but I do think lunch is really just a great way to really see somebody and really understand who they are.
One piece of advice you'd give your younger self starting today at Bowbrook?
To be true to yourself and say yes. You know, when you're asked to take on an assignment, take it.
I can absolutely relate to that. I kind of have the attitude of why say no when you can say yes. And then in the office and with clients and with other leaders, it's always how do we create a culture of yes? Yes, we can. How do we do it?
Yeah, I think that's great.
Mark, well, this has been great to spend some more time with you, hear your personal journey, hear the story of Bowbrook, taking a relatively boring product and continuing to innovate, but also hearing, as the first piece of our family business series, hearing about you and your son, Matthew, and how you're thinking about the future of Bowbrook. I'm really happy to have you on today's podcast.
Thank you.
Mark, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun. I know I certainly learned a lot of leadership lessons, a lot about your company, your business, your family. It's a story and a really powerful example of how long-term leadership, commitment to people, and a focus on continuous innovation can sustain and grow a business across generations. On behalf of the Los Angeles Business Journal and PNC Bank, I want to thank all of you for listening. To ensure that you're notified about our future podcast releases, please be sure to subscribe or follow. Thank you again. We look forward to hosting you on the next episode of PNC C-Speak, The Language of Executives.